No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Estee Dinor. We'll be talking today more about the struggle that comes before the change, or another way to look at it. We'll be talking about manifestations of really rising, and I'm not using the word lightly, fascism throughout the world. In the second part of the hour, we will be talking with Kostas Panayotakis about Golden Dawn, the neo-Nazi party in Greece, its ascent, the recent arrest of some of its leaders, and other things that have been happening in Greece. Before that, we have here in the studio Brother Damon and CJ Terrell, and delighted to have you guys. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it.
And the video of the day you were arrested, August 26, has become viral. People have seen it all over the world. I would like you each to describe what happened to you that day. I think the videos show it quite clearly, but interestingly enough, you were each charged with a number of charges, and you are still dealing with that, and we'll want to talk about that. But I think CJ, you were the first to be tackled and assaulted.
So I guess I was in the middle of the rotunda, and I had a hammer started being sung, and you know, the funny story about this is, this was my second time back at the sing-along. I had not been back in the Capitol building for very long, before all of this occurred. So I came back and was singing, and I'm looking out from the center of the rotunda down the hallways, and I see two lines of police officers, roughly 15 to 20. And, you know, I say police officers because I'm trying not to offend people, but these were not police officers. These are pigs, and I refuse to call them that, I guess. I'm done saying that. But anyway, I looked out and I saw them, and up until this point that day, the most cops they had on the rotunda floor was 3 at any one time. This was 15 to 20. And from my experience in the Capitol building, I know that means they're coming for me, right? And that's not a good feeling.
Why do you say that? What do you mean when you say that?
I mean, there's been a pattern over the last 3 years. There are some folks and we all know who we are, who are targeted at the Capitol building differently than the average citizen. And really, it's almost as if there's a few different levels of there's different stratospheres that the police put you in, and they treat you differently based on where you lie in that. You know, there's the Walker administration and their cronies, and they're like at the top. They're like treated like human beings, right?
More than that.
Right. They're treated like gods.
Little
maybe.
Gods. Yeah.
And then there's the level of folks that are like, you know, the Dem, you know, majority
lawmakers, leaders
and the lawmakers, and, you know, they're treated on a level where they're like, they're lesser. Right. They don't have the same rights as the Republicans do in the building, but like they still, because they wear suits and ties and walk around feeling important, they have more rights than the average person. And then there's like people who are there like to support Scott Walker. There's like 4 of them, but they're like treated like average human beings, probably. Lobbyists, you know, they come in and out the back doors. You barely ever see them. But And then there's like the general protesters, folks that show up to sing-alongs, folks that show up to meetings, to express themselves and to redress their grievances. And you know, those folks are treated as subhuman. But then amongst that group, there's a targeted number of folks.
There always is.
And the goal of the Capitol Police, in my opinion, and I only say in my opinion because I don't want to make this sound like it's absolute truth, right? Nobody has the absolute truth, but I'm pretty sure that the goal of the Capitol Police is to split this second group of people away from the original protesters and or away from the larger group of political dissents.
So, and these people are what?
These are younger people, darker people, more outspoken people, people who have shown a proclivity for actually reading the rules before just following what the police say. The people who stand up when the police say, you need to do this, even though there's no actual rule or law supporting what the police are saying.
Okay, so they were coming for you, you felt, and yeah, what happened?
And what happened was they came for me. What a coincidence. So they marched through the circle of people in the rotunda, and they stopped and waited. And as the first group of like four waited right in front of me, the rest of them fanned out around the outside of the rotunda, and they came in from every side. they walked up to me, and the officer said, I had been identified as an illegal participant in an unlawful event, which is hilarious to me because he didn't even tell me who identified me or under what authority, right? Under state statute, police do not have the authority to arrest for a forfeiture.
96807.
Yeah, it's
that was Damon.
Arrest by a law enforcement officer. They can arrest you if they have a warrant for your arrest, if they have a reason to believe that there's a warrant out for your arrest locally, if they have a reason to believe there's a felony warrant out for your arrest nationally, or if they have reason to believe that you have committed or are in the process of committing a crime. And then 939.12, crime defined, clearly states that anything punishable by only a forfeiture is not a crime. Right. So when he came in and said, you have been identified as a participant in an unlawful event, which
note it's event and not assembly. We'll get into that.
An unlawful event is classified under the administrative code as a forfeiture violation. Right. So I sat down and I said, OK, you can cite me. Right. You know, if you that's when I'll fight in court. Give me the ticket.
and suddenly.
And they grabbed me.
As one can see in the video.
I wasn't even told I was under arrest. They just started grabbing me by the neck and
and you can see four or five of them just tackling you, and suddenly you're invisible from having cops all over you.
It was not pretty. They started wrenching my wrist. I heard my brother roughly 10 feet behind me or so, and all I heard was no, no, and then and five bodies hit the floor right behind me, you know, and to look around surrounded by cops and see, you know, your brother's limbs sticking out and he had like four different large officers kneeling on him. It's scary, you know. And in my estimation, this was a tactical, militarized attack by the police officers, and they were by the pigs, sorry, and they were intentionally trying to incite violence. And that is not the duty of a police officer, which is why they're pigs. Their job is not to escalate. Their job is to de-escalate any situation that would arise. Now, no situation existed before they showed up. Right. And then they came and I think what they were doing was trying to get my brother or I to see the fact that the other one was in very real danger. Right. And to act violently. they were trying to incite violence from one of us. Mm-hmm.
Or really anything that could be construed there.
Yeah.
A quick motion from a hand, and I'll get into my arrest, but I think they were trying to actually get me to fall the other direction. But anything that could be construed as violence, which is easy when you're a brown man in this society.
Right, right. And you were, sorry, you were videotaping...
taking pictures, yeah.
Taking pictures when they attacked you, which was really just seconds, it looks like, after CJ was tackled.
Well, and as many seconds as they had planned on. As my brother said, this is the type of tactical military assault that is... The stuff of wet dreams for someone like Irwin, who was a security officer for Walker for years. You know, how often do you have 20 officers at your disposal and you can get them to fan out and execute in different... I'm sure it was quite beautiful on paper.
And it seemed, CJ, from the video, it seemed like they were holding you in, pain compliance?
They call it pain compliance. Really,
you seem to be in pain.
They were attempting to break my wrist. Had I not stood up, they would have at a couple different points there. My wrist was in serious actual danger of being broken by a police officer for not standing up for an illegal arrest, right? This is a very common thing for them. They feel like because they're wearing a suit with a gun on the hip and a badge, that they have the right to do whatever because everything they say is a lawful order, and that's just not true.
Right.
And beyond that, you can see improperly applied pain compliance very often from these officers, and something that they don't know about us is that, you know, I studied martial arts for quite some time. I know not a lot, but a little about pain and how the body works, and especially the first officer that attempted a pain compliance was a little giddy and couldn't find the right spot behind his ear. And despite the fact that some of them are wearing gloves, she wasn't and caused considerable damage. That's also very frustrating to see so much practice and execution of the assault, but not so much of the techniques.
Yeah. Well, Damon, and then you were arrested and were in for 3 days and charged with a multiplicity of...
false accusations, yeah.
And you came out 3 days later, and, you know, I can see we're never going to have enough time to discuss everything we wanted to discuss today. We'll probably have to have you guys here again. But when you came out, there's a video, and you say there was a whole bunch of people who came to welcome you. And you say there, thank you for making some of these lessons I've been trying to learn for so long come true. What did you mean by that?
The first thing is, you know, you come out of the shoot only a few hours after, you know, the statutory requirements for your probable cause hearing and specifically designed to keep people who didn't commit crimes from spending excessive amounts of time in jail. And, you know, to see your community there was awesome. In particular, one of the first faces that was in the front of the crowd was a mentor of mine in organizing, in direct action organizing, specifically Erica. And we always used to talk about the power of individuals and the power of a community. And when you see the district attorney, the attorney general, a slew of police officers, and frankly, a community all complicit in allowing these types of atrocities to occur regularly. When you see them actually attempt to steal years of your life from you, there's this funny thing that happens to people who wear suits too long, right? And they convince themselves that this is what they're supposed to be doing. I fully believe that without that mass of people, I would still be in jail. I fully believe that without the folks that cared about not only myself but my community and really came out day after day and organized themselves into something powerful, a force that was needed, I would still be rotting as they intend for my people to rot.
So you learn the power of numbers, basically.
Right. And it's something I teach. I've seen it before. But in
organizing and
fighting for change. And in your personal life, it really sinks the message in that now everything that I do from that day, all the people that I touch, all the people that I share that message with, it's compounded because it's only possible because of its truth. And I think that that's a really powerful thing that I took away from that.
I see. We do have a call for you, and there's definitely at least one more question that I want to squeeze in before the half hour is gone. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Esty, it's Willie. A number of times I was with our late great civil rights crusader, Ben Mazel, when he was about to be arrested. Does anybody do what he did back then, which was he always would inform the police before they grabbed him that he had the absolute right to defend himself because the police in this case, in these cases, are committing a crime and citizens have a right to defend themselves against anybody, including a police officer,
who is
committing a crime.
All right, Willie,
is there
thanks.
A reason this sort of tactic is not used? Thanks very much for the program.
Damon, you wanted to answer that.
I am super excited about that question, actually. Thank you. So one of the reasons that I was assaulted that day, I firmly believe, is my activity informing people of that. Beyond organizing folks to hold cops are behind you signs to just give people the courtesy of knowing they were about to be illegally arrested. I was starting to very loudly actually question officers every time they came up. You know that this is a forfeiture. You know that you can't make this arrest. Why are you doing it? And they wouldn't give me an answer. The reality is that, unfortunately, in 1989 it was, the right to forcibly resist unlawful arrest was abrogated in the state of Wisconsin. That said, to my knowledge, there's a legal gray area surrounding passive resistance. Regardless, these officers were committing a crime. They had no authority to arrest in that situation, and they knew it, and they knew that I knew it, which when you look up 946, what is it, 42? That's 41.
Resisting
and obstructing an officer. There's three prongs of proving that crime.
There should be five.
Those are in the case law. Thank you, State of Wisconsin, for having all of that, as well as the laws available online. That said, there's...
Maybe you shouldn't say it, or they'll take it offline.
Unfortunately, we still have strong public libraries, hippies. You rock. So, moving into that discussion, I had been informing people that these were illegal arrests, and I had been questioning their authority to make these arrests, quite publicly. Unfortunately for myself, though, I literally got maybe 10 words out of my mouth before I was assaulted and thrown to the floor. And actually, as I'm on the floor, you can hear me screaming, what are you doing? This is a forfeiture. As I'm on the floor, you can hear me screaming, hey, last time they took me, they lied about where they took me and strapped me for hours to a gurney. You can hear me discussing my history with these officers that clearly show that one of the prongs was not met, which is that I did not believe that was a lawful arrest. Therefore, I cannot be resisting. And beyond that, two cases in particular, Lossman and also, what's the last one? Not Ferguson, be the State of Wisconsin. Both of those cases informed.
I think you guys should go to law school.
Hopefully.
It's a rather antagonistic place for folks like me.
Working out a scheme to try to get into law, or trying to pass the bar without going to law school. But furthermore, you know, the police officers knew that they didn't have the legal authority to arrest. They knew that we knew they didn't have the legal authority to arrest. And we were surrounded by like 200 of our community members, right? Wielding cameras from all angles.
Right.
And they were willing to do this here.
Yes.
And people wonder why we didn't want to go to the basement with these people where there were more police officers and no cameras and none of our community.
Mm-hmm. Well,
right?
And to fill in a couple of the blanks, I'm sorry, there's a lot of history here and there's a lot of policy here. The reality is that they designed this policy specifically to oppress us. We know that this is not a constitutional policy, which is why it fails under Ferguson. But that all aside, that argument still to be had in January when we hear back that this is unconstitutional. Even under their own failed policy, the emergency rules that change administrative code 2, they do not have the power to arrest because under state statute 16.84, I think that's maintenance of state buildings, they talk about the penalties under sub 1 and sub 2. I have more of this if anybody wants to contact me.
Yeah, this is a lot of detail that I think for many of us it's hard to follow. But I got this information from Rebecca Campbell, who I'm sure you know, probably our best investigative reporter at this point here in Madison.
Very much. Hi, Rebecca.
And it's from an article that she wrote some time ago for The Progressive, but she mentions here Captain Todd Kuschel of the Capitol Police, who was hired as a full-time officer in 2011, and said in one of these court appearances that he's in charge of special operations with overall responsibilities for control. I'm third in command after the chief and deputy chief. He used to work for private consulting firm Halcrow CH2M Hill on an OAS contract in Barbados, training port workers on incident command systems. So he's a guy who's a specialist in crowd control and as he calls it,
suppression
incident
of
command.
Oh, systems. Sorry, incident command.
Yes, and so he was employed there during the time of Chief Tubbs, and there's something very shocking, I think, to learn that someone like that was hired in 2011 specifically to work these situations that you guys have been part of. We have only 3 minutes left, unfortunately. I really will have to have you sometime soon again to continue this conversation. But Damon, who's going to answer? CJ.
Yeah, I'll answer. This is not unique to this officer or this department. This is something that's happening worldwide, and what we're seeing is a militarization of the police force from top to bottom. I mean, the New York Police Department literally opened a chapter in Jerusalem, right? So there's a building in Jerusalem that says New York Police Department on the door, right? And they're sending cops from New York to learn how to basically conduct tactical military strikes on our own citizens.
Yes, because Israel is so good at that in the occupied territories.
Chief Tubbs, who is unfortunately, in my opinion, beloved by a few too many protesters, was with Homeland Security before he became the chief of Capitol Police. He retired, was brought out of retirement to be the Capitol Police chief, and then after being removed for Irwin, he is now working with the Homeland Security Department again. So, you know, there are a lot of connections to militarization of police force, and it's not a coincidence that we're seeing police departments get more and more money, even as they're telling us we're broke, we're broke, we're broke. And, you know, we're cutting books from children and we're adding to the police force. When was the last time you saw a police car that wasn't freshly washed? You know, they're leaving the squad cars running on the side of the roads. If we were actually running out of money, they would turn off the cars because that's a waste of money, right? And I think Damon would like to chime in here for a second.
It's the danger that lies in believing that the only people in this world with corrupt intentions are the poor, right? That's when we start believing that folks who smile at you are nice, even if their express purpose on this earth is to hunt you. So that aside, I just want to give a brief update on
actually,
where we're at.
It shows something about the level to which the American people have adopted, if you will, slave mentality, so that there's the nicer
Stockholm
master.
Syndrome. I call it Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, the Stockholm syndrome thing, yes.
It's intense. And the same thing happens with like Ismael Ozan, who, as the consummate politician, only took 4 weeks to dismiss the clearly absurd criminal charges over my head and, you know, felt it necessary to file malicious charges against my brother for resisting arrest, which on its face isn't possible in this scenario, considering they were, again, arresting for something that's not, it's neither a crime nor does it have a criminal component. That's why they're coming after us for unlawful assembly as opposed to event. But that said, my brother still has 2 cases against him. He's being prosecuted by 2 branches of the state government right now. So if you want to find out how to support him, please do. I luckily only have the one AG.
How can one learn and support?
If you contact me on Facebook, CJ Terrell, just shoot me a message and I can...
Two R's, two L's.
Yep.
If you can get somebody to the Capitol between noon and 1, somebody can find us generally. Beyond that, we have a court date on the 1st.
Both of you?
Yeah.
On the 1st of November?
Yeah, and that's just for the Attorney General. They split CJ's cases, so he'll have an additional one, I believe, on the 3rd.
Fourth, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm sorry that we have to cut this conversation, but as I said, we'll have you again. Really delightful to have you. Thank you so much.
As always, much appreciated.
For joining us, and we'll go with some music by Pavlos Fissas, the anti-fascist rapper who was killed by the Golden Dawn in Greece. And we'll be back talking about Greece.
Καλοκαίρι, υψηλή θερμοκρασία, πετά το άγχος και το στρες. Και πάμε παραλία για να απολαύσουμε και φέτος. Πολύχρωμα μπικίνι όταν σας βλέπω, κορίτσια. Η καρδιά μου ανοίγει, πάντα ένα μέρα και ουλαλαλα. Καυτά σοκολατένια, γυναικεία κορμιά. Ένα προς ένα ανοίγουν δεξιά και αριστερά. Παίρνω άλλον αέρα από τα Κανάρια νησιά. Hasta la vista και la vida loca. Στην παραλία οργανώνω από σε κόλπα. Βάζω φωτιά, τσίτα, μουσική και πάμε. Τζαμάικα, ο κώδικος έως το πρωί γλεντάμε. Κάθε ήλιο βασίλεμα και ένα καινούριο πάρτι. Κάθε ξημέρωμα και μια καινούρια αγάπη. Μπουρό αβάνας και μια μπύρα στο χέρι. Μια μελάκρινη αγκαλιά και μια ευχή σε πέφτα στέλη. Ρούμι τεκίλα στο επεισόδιο αυτό. Βλέπεις το μωρό μου ανήκει για την πρωταγωνιστό. Οι μέρες είναι λίγες μα οι γυναίκες πολλές. Άντε καλό καλοκαίρι και καλές διακοπές.
And that was Pavlos Fissas, as I said, the anti-fascist rapper who was assassinated not that long ago by the Golden Dawn. To discuss the situation in Greece, we have with us again Kostas Panayotakis. He is a professor of sociology at the New York City College of Technology of the City University of New York, also author of Remaking Scarcity from Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. And he writes, you can find his writing on the net. And hello, Kostas, thank you for joining us again.
Hello, it's good to be with you.
And the latest that I know of, anyway, is that the Greek police has actually arrested Nikolas Mikaloliakos, the leader of Golden Dawn, as well as some other leaders of the party. Some of them have been released, not all of them. It has taken, it seems, the police and the government quite a while to do that. Tell us, please, what is the Golden Dawn? Why have its leaders been arrested? And what generally is going on right now in Greece?
Yes, the Golden Dawn is a neo-Nazi organization that has been around for almost 20 years. And for a long time, it was a very marginal group. But what distinguishes it, first of all, is that it's not just a party of the extreme right with anti-immigrant and racist views, but it has also a paramilitary organization with groups that basically go around the streets, of, especially in big cities like Athens, and terrorize immigrants and lately also Greeks who don't agree with its ideology and its methods. And what has happened is that in the last 2 years or so, Golden Dawn has seen its support among the Greek population skyrocket as the economic crisis and the austerity policies of the government has taken a great toll on people. So this background of economic crisis and suffering on the part of the population made it possible for Golden Dawn to get 7% of the vote in last year's election, and to be actually now the third most popular party according to recent polls.
Mm-hmm.
They've been charged for being a criminal organization because they've actually been responsible for hundreds of attacks, immigrants, but also Greeks. And for a long time, the Greek state, the authorities, the police, had shown great tolerance towards them. And at times, there is even footage that the Golden Dawn oftentimes operated side to side with riot police against demonstrators. But now, because of the uproar that was created by the killing of Pavlos Fissas, and there was a powerful anti-fascist movement that grew increased demonstrations, and there was also pressure from outside of the government, like Europe and so on. So the government was forced to do something about it, and basically many of the cases that were sort of lying idle, the government decided to send them to the courts in order to make a case that Golden Dawn is a criminal organization, and it is as a criminal organization that the leaders of Golden Dawn are being now prosecuted. And a couple of dozen of their members have already been arrested, including some police officers who are charged with working with Golden Dawn. And these are serious charges, and some of them were released on bail, but the charges are still, you know, they haven't gone away. So there will be a trial even of the people who were released. But both the leader of Golden Dawn and some of the other deputies of Golden Dawn have been sent back to custody.
Mm-hmm. Why has it taken so long? Why is it that hundreds of attacks on immigrants, on Greeks, and yet it takes the murder of a well-known artist before something happens? Why is there a collusion, it seems anyway, between the government and Golden Dawn?
Well, unfortunately, there has been a long history of collaboration between the extreme right in Greece and the state, including, you know, the police, the army, and so on and so forth. And that goes back to the civil war after World War II, when there was a civil war between the communist left in Greece and the right wing. And, of course, the right wing prevailed. This happened against the backdrop of the Cold War, of course. And ever since, what had happened is that, the extreme right had a niche in the Greek state. And it was so there was lots of sympathy and collaboration between the Greek state and the extreme right. And what has happened, of course, since in the last few years with the policies of austerity, Golden Dawn, in a certain way, has been useful, I think, to the powers that be, because on the one hand, they sort of have a stance against austerity, but on the other hand, in the parliament, again and again, they have stood with sectors of Greek capital, like ship owners and the banks and so on and so forth. So one of the their functions, I think, has been to absorb some of the discontented people who have abandoned the ruling parties and who might have otherwise moved to the left, and they have basically prevented a significant segment of the disenchanted citizens who see their, you know, lives destroyed by these policies. They have prevented this sector of the population to move to the left, which has become, you know, a major threat to the continuation of the rule of these pro-austerity parties that over the last few decades presided over Greece and have brought Greece to its current state. So they played, I think, a useful function. So they were tolerated, and in fact, austerity has created more and more opposition because, you know, there is almost no group in Greek population that has not been seriously hit by these policies. There is growing opposition. So there has been more and more government repression, and democracy has been undermined. And so what you have is that the conservatives, who are the largest party within the government, have become more authoritarian and have actually tried to appropriate some of the anti-immigrant rhetoric of Golden Dawn. They have sort of, they lost many of the supporters of Golden Dawn, used to be supporters of the Conservative Party. So for a long time, the strategy of the conservatives was to try to pander to the voters of Golden Dawn to get them to, you know, come back to the Conservative Party. And there had even been scenarios and voices within the Conservative Party that perhaps in the future there could be a coalition government between the Conservatives and Golden Dawn. So it's pretty clear that, you know, the sort of ruling parties did not necessarily see Golden Dawn as the kind of threat that it should be seen as, and it was tolerated to some extent, seen as useful. But as Golden Dawn has shown its support increase and it has become more and more brazen, the pressure to do something about it mounted, and they were forced to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. 256-2001, 1-866-899-WORT, at War Talk, or A Public Affair on Facebook if you want to join the conversation, which is short. Unfortunately, we're squeezing two very important issues today. My guest is Kostas Panayotakis. I guess we'll go to our first caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a question of the guest. If I would be interested in knowing if he can make some connections between, or comparisons between, the Golden Dawn and the junta, the military junta of the late 1960s and early 1970s, if he has some historical knowledge of that, or if there are any actual ties between the two. And I'll listen to the comments off the air, okay?
Thank you. Kostas.
The Golden Dawn and its leaders are very nostalgic of the military junta in the late 60s and early 1970s. They have praised them in various rallies. They've had the leader of Golden Dawn was at some point appointed the leader of the youth wing of a party that had been basically established by the leader of the junta after the end of the junta, when the leader of the former leader of the junta, Papadopoulos, was in prison. There had been attempts to create political formations that that followed the same ideas that were inspired by the ideas of the fascist regime of the junta in the late 60s and 70s. So yes, there are clear ties, and there has always been a stream of the extreme right in Greece going back to the Greek Civil War. But the extreme right had been delegitimated in the 70s because of the experience of the military junta that was very, very brutal. It tortured people. It created a national catastrophe with, you know, the way it handled the situation in Cyprus that led to the invasion of Turkey and the occupation of the northern part of the island, and it also had brutally repressed a student revolt in 1973. So as a result, the extreme right had for a long time been delegitimized, but and it was weak. But in recent years, because of these austerity policies, you have this neo-Nazi, you know, formation become very strong. And it's kind of ironic in a way, because to have a neo-Nazi group become so strong in Greece, since Greece was a country that suffered terribly under Nazi occupation. And I think it's sort of a reminder, of course, that, you know, fascism is a recurrent phenomenon that capitalist crisis often you know, create. So it's unfortunately, I think, one of the sort of things that one of the sort of most powerful arguments that one could make against capitalism is its tendency to create crises that make phenomena like Nazism and fascism possible, even in places that one would never have expected.
Yes, yes. Well, let's get to our next caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. First I had some observations and questions about Golden Dawn. I've looked at their website, and it appears that they try to pretend they're like any other community service organization. It shows a lot of emphasis on their helping in the forest fires, putting them out like good citizens. And also, I've noticed that they're spreading abroad among the Greek communities in the U.S. and Australia. Is that any cause for alarm? And then my last question is sort of a follow-up on the previous caller, but is there any reason why Greece has been so susceptible to far-right politicians and political beliefs, probably more so than other Western European countries? And I'm wondering if that's because Greece, by its location, you know, is almost completely surrounded by communist countries like Albania and the former Yugoslavia, and if that creates a greater amount of fear of the spread of communism. I can take my answers off the air, and thanks for an interesting program. Take care.
Kostas.
I think one of the main reasons you have this development in Greece is like the mass, the sheer magnitude of the social catastrophe that exists. I mean, we're talking about unemployment of 28%. It's 60% unemployment among young people. I mean, the crisis in Greece right now is deeper than the Great Depression in the U.S. in the 1930s. So I think that facilitates. But at the same time, it's also true that there is serious economic crisis and unemployment problem in other countries of the South, although it could be argued that it might be even worse in the case of Greece. So I think there is a combination. You cannot attribute everything just to the economic crisis. The economic crisis by itself does not automatically create a phenomenon like that. It's always a convergence of factors. Part of it may have to do with the, you know, the sort of conditions specific to Greece, including the political conditions I mentioned, the tradition of the far right in Greece, but also it partly has to do with Greek geography. And I'm not sure it's necessarily a matter of being surrounded by former communist countries. I mean, there is an anti-communist tradition in Greece that goes back to the Civil War, as I mentioned. But it's also, it has to do with the great increase in the numbers of immigrants in Greece, who do not necessarily, are not coming to Greece because they want to stay in Greece. I mean, the conditions for immigrants in Greece are even worse than they are for Greeks. I mean, unemployment rates are higher, and of course, with Golden Dawn, I mean, you know, many immigrants are faced with literal terror. So most of the immigrants want to go to other European countries, but because of the European immigration policy, they're not allowed to. And even if they pass through Greece and they go to another European country and they don't have papers, if they are found, they are basically sent to their country of entry, which is Greece. So Greece has become an open, air prison for immigrants. And this has allowed Golden Dawn to scapegoat them and to present them as, you know, the source of the crisis, and to basically claim that the crisis would be solved if immigrants were kicked out.
Mm-hmm. And again, to look at the collusion between Golden Dawn and the government, I understand you just said that Greece has become an open-air prison for immigrants. I understand that there have been roundups of immigrants, forcing them into internment camps, and these were followed by rounding up sex workers, transgender people. This is all really very reminiscent of the Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of shows that in many ways Golden Dawn has had a palpable impact on, Greek policies, even without ever having been formally in power. They have pushed, the policies of the government and the rhetoric way to the right, and that's a very disturbing phenomenon, and it further legitimizes the extreme right, it legitimizes violence against immigrants. When you have, ministers of the Greek government saying that, the immigrant crisis, the immigrant problem is an even more serious problem than the economic crisis, when you have the prime minister saying before the elections, before he was elected prime minister, that Greece had been invaded by immigrants and that, Greece needed to reconquer the cities. I mean, this is the use of a really hyperbolic and even military language that sends the message to ordinary people that Greece is at war with immigrants. And, of course, what you do in times of war is, of course, you basically use violence against the enemy. So,
yeah.
So Greek political elites have a serious responsibility for what is going on, and they also legitimize the extreme right by also including an extreme right anti-immigrant party in a coalition government back in 2011. This party, in the meantime, has because it became part of an austerity government, it lost power. But the fact that the extreme right became for the first time part of the government gave room to the even more extreme and even more violent Golden Dawn to become the power that it is today. And I should also mention here, I've talked about the responsibility of the Greek elites, but we also have to realize that the European political and economic elites that have been imposing these policies on Greece and the South also have a responsibility, and they have also a responsibility for the kind of immigration policy that has created a bad situation in Greece and has made it possible for Golden Dawn to capitalize on this.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller for you. Let's get to that person. Hi, caller. Are you on the air?
Hi. Yes, I wanted to ask your guest about the Nazi resistance by the communists. I understood that they acted pretty brutally themselves. They were accusing ordinary people of being Nazi sympathizers, and they would summarily execute them. Or this is how they were portrayed in the book, Corley's Mandolin. I don't know if you've ever read that. But what role did this play in helping the right propagandize against communists? Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Thank you. Kostas?
Yeah, I mean, what happened basically was that towards the later stages of the Greek resistance against the Germans, all the powers involved were starting to plan for the days after the war. And this included, of course, the right wing, the communists, the Britain, which was trying to control Greece and have it under its sphere of influence after the war. So many historians would argue that the civil war started already before the end of the Nazi occupation, and the extreme right did. Many of the people on the right did collaborate with the Nazis, and they did terrorize people on the left. And it is true that after the end of the war, there was there were conflicts, military clashes between the left and the right, and many people were killed on both sides. And the left itself has a share of the responsibility. But that particular book, Eleni, I mean, it's a sort of a Cold War document. That it basically it's part of the Cold War anti-communist rhetoric. So I wouldn't sort of treat that as representative of what really happened. And I want to also to place things into context that this kind of persecution of German collaborators was not unique to Greece. So in France, for example, after the end of Nazi occupation, you know, thousands of Nazi collaborators were killed by people. So my sense is that you know, the kind of the far right, the right, was much more responsible for much more violence and terroristic activity than the left. But I don't want to completely absolve the left for its share of the responsibility.
Yeah.
But, of course, after the war, the resolution of the civil war meant that you had a kind of paradoxical situation that after the war, many of the collaborators of Germans ended up being part of the new post-war regime and being in power, while many of the people who had fought against the Nazis and who were on the left were persecuted, sent as were exiled to desert islands and put in prison for really long periods of time.
Mm-hmm. We have just about a minute and a half left, and there's two questions I wanted to make sure to tackle. You can choose. One is the environmental destruction that has been caused to Greece and the Greek islands because of the austerity, and the other one is the role of Germany in imposing the austerity, and since it really, I mean, Germany really takes central stage in that. Again, how can there be neo-Nazis? How can there be sympathies to the Nazis?
Yeah, I think the German Chancellor Merkel is the German political elites are following a strategy that has completely destroyed the country and that has made it possible for the neo-Nazis to rise. So they bear a responsibility, which is for the rise of neo-Nazism in Europe, which is, of course, even more serious given the fact that, given the role that Germany has had in the rise of Nazism and fascism in the past. As for the environmental destruction, that's certainly the case. Because of austerity, this situation, this crisis, has given the government an excuse to say that anything can be done to attract investment. We shouldn't think about environmental consequences. And now, and there have been movements against this environmental destruction, including against investments by transnational companies in gold mines that threaten to create massive pollution in you know, very beautiful and pristine areas of Greece. And the way the government has responded to this movement is through repression and through an attempt to criminalize these movements and to treat them as equivalent to the violence of Golden Dawn.